You have 4 pages handed out to you today, is that correct? Romans 1:18, 1:19, 1:20. Is that correct? You've got it all memorized now. As I read to you last Sunday and commented that among all the commentaries on Romans, the 3 that come from the pen of someone who preached the messages to an ordinary audience, Boyce, Barnhouse, and Jones. And they all, I quoted Jones and Boyce last Sunday, Barnhouse says essentially the same thing. No preacher wants to preach who knows the love of God, wants to preach on wrath. I grew up in a church frame where there was a saying about, well, we need an evangelist to come by that can preach some hellfire and brimstone. The gospel is the message. Paul is on this subject to create some awareness of our need of the gospel. Very few people today are aware of that need. For change, rarely, but for change, the religion section of the Times reviewed a book worth reading. Now, it carries within it that frame of mutual respect for all religions, which is probably why it got on the Times list, but by the son of a Chinese missionary, Houston Smith, whose other book, The World's Religions, stands as a classic. The title of the book is Why Religion Matters, in which he has pointed out the lost condition and the blindness of today's materialistic world. And I got a glimpse of it on the way here. I happened to stop at a stop sign. In front of me was a sport utility vehicle with a little saying around its license plate. When hell freezes over, I will ski there too. Humorous, but profoundly illustrative of the state of mind today. Hell is so meaningless that you can poke fun at it. Hell is such a archaic and stupid mental midgetry idea in the minds of this smart mouth generation that you can joke about it. When hell freezes over, I will ski there too. Well, be my guest. And make God's day. The wrath of God is reality. And to the preachers who don't want to talk about it, this is what Barnhouse has to say. Now we come to the revelation of the wrath of God by the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. It would be pleasant not to have to preach on this subject, but if one sets out to be an expositor of the Word of God, it is necessary to consider all of the revelation of truth and order in the order in which God has seen fit to deliver it to us. The minister has no right of choice. Though there are some ministers that seek to interpose their choice and priority over the divine revelation. Suppose the case of a boy who goes to the unemployment department of Western Union in one of our great cities. He asks for a job delivering telegrams, and the manager tells him he can start at once. But, says the boy, there's one thing I should warn you about. I am psychologically so constituted that I cannot stand any scene of unhappiness. I will deliver all of the telegrams that tell of fortunes being made, of congratulations for success, of acceptance for marriage, in short, all of the telegrams that are of joy and bliss. But all the telegrams concerning sickness and death and loss are alien to my nature, and I will not deliver them. It will not take the manager long to say there was no place for such a messenger in the company. And those preachers that will not deliver the whole gospel will be waiting to ski in hell until it does freeze over. Now, apocalypticai which begins this 18th verse, apo, out from, kaluptatai, buried, concealed, hidden, veiled, covered, something that has been buried is now out from the burial ground, out from behind the veil, out from behind the covering. 17th verse, the gospel, the good news of God's new way, where for faith He gives us righteousness, where something we can do, trust, is what connects us to God, and He does the rest. That was unveiled in the gospel. The basis is all unveiled in the gospel. Through many verses, Paul has said, this prophesied happening brings us to the point of the kingdom of God with power, where the risen Lord now can dispense to us the power that raised up Him from the dead simply for trusting Him. Why is it important that this wonderful message be sent abroad? Why is it important that we run to this message as hearers of faith? Because we live here and now and forever in that message. Everybody else dies. And therefore, before Paul goes on to expound this gospel in fullness, he takes this diversion in the minds of some to explain why the gospel is needed. Because God's fed up with something, and at the same time, and in the present tense, the wrath, the slow boil of God's anger, the wrath of God is also being uncovered. That wrath of God from heaven is against, epi, all a Sabian Adikion. We have spent a lot of time on those two words. A Sabian. Ah being the lack or the reverse. It puts, to go to the Greek root, the seb word, in reverse. The seb word is an attitude of awareness, respect, awe. It's that state of mind that, properly understood, invokes the word fear in the phrase, the fear of God, but a healthy fear. Have you ever come in the presence of someone that, from your view, whether it's a sports figure, a spiritual leader, a lot of these reactions are based upon your own career choices and ambitions. But a giant in an area that invokes respect. Someone you've, and I use the word cautiously, idolized, looked up to, admired, and you get an audience. Have any of you ever come into anyone's presence like that to create just a little bit of a knot in the stomach, a little bit of tightness in various places and nervousness? Anybody? That's a said word. It is respect. It is awe. In its earliest use, it meant a shrinking from or drawing back. There were two streams of meaning. One was drawing back in revulsion, like a dead body that has been dead several days, and the stench revolts you. But as it matriculated through the Greek language, the religious meaning of awe and sort of shrinking back with respect and awareness took over. The opposite of what was on that license plate. Absolute, utter, ignorant disregard of sneering at God's ultimate wrath fulfillment place in the present age of grace. When we've been rescued, not only from the wrath that is now, but the wrath to come. A thoughtless, mindless disregard. A total lack of respect, awareness, for anything supernatural, eternal, and a sovereign, righteous God who decides who is in right relationship with Him, and He will spend company with throughout eternity. A Sabian lack of awareness, respect. Later on, Paul will say, failure to worship and give thanksgiving. Just total unawareness. You ever been in a room with a loved one? Marriages and love affairs that go stale. Where you're in the room with someone, but you might as well not be. Because they have no awareness of your presence. Ignored, insignificant in their consciousness envelope. You ever had that experience? That's a Sabian toward God. He's not part of the equation of their conscious awareness. Adikion, not being and doing His standard of behavior for this life. Apart from the grace of the gospel, where God says, I will do it for you if you trust me, apart from that trusting relationship of righteousness, all mankind falls under the judgment scan of the law. Whether they know it or not, they still are under that standard. God is what He is. His standard has been declared. The law is what behavior looks like if in the human flesh God could be Himself in human flesh, and we find this being done in Christ, and everyone falls short of that performance. So the wrath of God is against those who ignore Him, and because they ignore Him, have no expressed, obvious awareness of His presence, value of it, worship of it, and thanksgiving for Him. And they live a life that doesn't measure up to His standard. That's what God's wrath's against. Well, I never heard of you, God. I'm outside the revelation. And Paul starts talking first after the statement that all who live in the state, Asabian, Asabian, and Adikion, all of them are under the recipients of the uncovering of God's wrath. And then he begins to address those that have never had special revelation. Anyone who has encountered this special revelation knows more and thus are more accountable than the world that's never heard of Christ, and there's fewer and fewer of those in the world, those that have never encountered His special revelation. And Paul anticipates the excuse, well, how can you dump on me when I didn't know about you? How can a God be mad at me for not practicing some awareness of His presence and living up to His standard of righteousness where I don't even know He exists? I've had no special revelation. He hasn't tapped me on the shoulder. I didn't come out of the seed of Abraham. And I have no knowledge of what His standard is. So how can He let His wrath come down on me? That's the 19th verse. Let's camp out there for a few minutes. Because, nice way to start the answer. If you watch Saturday Night Live, George Bush, cuz. How can God get on these people and have His wrath poured out on them when they've never even heard of Him? Because. Well, they don't know His law. And it'd be unfair to get on them. So why would He do it? Because. Because what? I'll tell you. Because that which may be known, no stone. Because that which may be known of God is manifest. Phanaron. Notice your word to you that have the piece of paper is phanaron. The stem, you know, Greek is made from stems. Fan. And not one you cool off in hell while you ski with. Phanaron. Because that which may be known about God, Eston Phanaron, translated here manifest, but I'll say more about it. And your little translation there, which is the popular translation, says among, but if you'll notice, it's in the dative case. That's what the D is underneath it. And what's the dative case? No movement. Among is okay. But in is the purer meaning, that which may be known of God. What? Wait, I don't know anything about God. Therefore, how can your wrath come on me? Cause. That which may be known is capable of being known or seen. In this case, grasped intellectually, is manifest, phaneron, in them, for God, through them, manifested it. Past tense is that E in front of it, phanerosen, same word, phanerosen. Now let's look up this little word. Phano and phanerosen. This is that 9-10 volume theological dictionary of the New Testament, one of the greatest works of scholarship to come down in this century. Phano. Phaneros. Phana, am I borrowing you? Boring you? Borrowing you. Phana, roo, phanerosis, phantazo, phantasmo, phantasma, and phanizo, epiphanino, epiphanis, epiphanii. All of those words have the root fan. It's obviously, this book says, an ancient extension of fa, Indo-European ba, which can mean both to illumine, to make visible, also to speak, and to make audible. From the time of Homer, the word means to manifest, to show, to shine, to gleam, to light up, to arise and shine, to show forth oneself. Now God is saying that even to the ignorant heathen outside any special revelation, what can be known about God, what may be known about God, has shined, been illumined, shown forth itself, and done it to all of them. How? Well, that takes us to the 20th verse. How? Cause. The gar can be for or because. Was this explaining or just went before? For the invisible things. Aorata. Now the ah in front of that word. The ah in front of that word makes it in reverse, negative, the opposite, not. The word, the root, ola, without the ah in front of it, it's got the aspirate in reverse, is hola, oral. Haral means to see. Just that simple. Now they've translated invisible things, but it's really saying for the not seen things. You don't follow me on this heavy stuff? Invisible, that's a nice little English attempt to say not seen. The invisible things are not seen, so the translation's okay, but I want you to see that the root word is to see. Hola. For the things not seen of him. For the things not seen of him from creation, apo creation, and apo can mean a lot of things, but in this case context and in the normal use it means from, it's got a temporal meaning, from the beginning, from the time of creation, the not seen invisible things, from the world's creation, by the things made, poemason, being understood. Now let's follow this word order with all these little numbers. Can I? You got the paper in front of you? And I'll read it the way the numbers are. Gar, 4. Ta, V. You gotta go down to 3. For the worlds, cosmu. No. For the invisible things. Go clear down to the next to the last line. Kakarotai, are clearly seen. Follow that now? The second word on your paper is gar, 4. The first word, ta, is the particle, the definite article. For the invisible things of him, how to, the first word of the next line, go clear down to the next to the last line, are clearly seen. You follow that? Katharotai, are clearly seen, and back up to the second line, apo, from, and the first word of the third line, the worlds, cosmu, then back to the second line, creation, katiseos, then go down to the fifth line, noumena, being understood. Back up to the third line, tois, by the. And then the fifth line again, first word, things made, poimasen. Got that? Now we've used up every word down to the first word of the fifth line. Then you pick it up again. Both. How to, in the bottom line, second word, his, first line, ideos, everlasting, dunamis, power, and diotes, divinity, ice, to, them, autos, to be, for them to be unapologetos, without excuse, without apology. Now, I don't want to take the time of the rules of grammar of both case, gender, tense, that enable the Greek scholars to rework the word the way it should be. You have that strangeness to the English language. And one of the hardest things for an ordinary Americano to learn is in Italian, in Spanish, that reversal. You don't say, I like coffee. You say, the coffee likes me. And one of the hardest things was to figure out that I didn't use the first person when I would speak of, if I was going to say I like coffee, I'd say, yo gusto. But that's the way it happens. You have to put it in the third person because the subject is the coffee. It likes me. And I become an object. Well, that's the hardest thing to get in your head when you're first learning is you learn all these tenses and you know that, well, I'm the subject, and they don't help you in the textbooks. They never literally say the coffee likes me. They translate it, I like the coffee. Now, I'm sitting there saying, well, what a dumb teacher you are. I mean, I'm saying, the translation says, I like coffee, and I look up there, and the verb for like is in the third person. And how can I say, I like coffee, and use the wrong person of the verb? And it took a long time for me to figure out they're talking backwards. And then for me to realize that to them I'm talking backwards. I mean, any fool can figure out the coffee likes me. Otherwise, it wouldn't give me this good taste. And when you spit it out, you know the damn coffee doesn't like you at all. It's the foulest thing, man. Anything that would put a taste in your mouth like that, it's proper to explain it as it doesn't like me. Well, Greek's the same way. There are word orders, and there's suffixes at the end of the word enable you to tie, even though it's a complicated sentence that is written in the Greek to make it flow. You have to analyze the tenses and the cases, and you can figure out which word is connected to what other word or words, and that makes this a very complicated sentence, hard to translate in literal flow. But the reason I took that time is I want you to see two things. Literally, the first phrase is for the not seen things, down in the fifth line, katharotai, are clearly seen. Now, katha at the front carries something to an extension, makes it ultimate or complete. And if you look at katharotai, you've got the same root in it there. See in the middle of the word? Ora. You see that? The same word. Translated differently in the English, but in the Greek, it's the same word. For the things not seen are clearly seen. Now, this brings me to my... It's been so many years, I don't know whether it's my uncle or my granddad. God, wouldn't you understand the Bible? Why didn't you write the damn things if you could understand it? Direct quote. And I could see him with this verse. Why are these people the recipients of God's wrath when they don't even know about God? Cause. What do you mean, cause? Cause of things that may be known are made manifest and have been manifested from the first day of creation. How? Cause the things not seen are clearly seen. You got that? You ever heard the phrase oxymoron? Now, yuppies love to use that word to describe somebody they don't like and they don't even know what it means. It's a literary device in rhetoric to state something apparently contradictory to emphasize the truth even more. This is an oxymoron, a well-established literary device. There are some things, that's why some languages have phrases that cannot be translated into other languages. That's why when you first begin to learn a language, you slip into the pit of thinking in your home language, and you got to learn a language pretty far along the trip to be able to start thinking in that new language. And so we're always translating the new language into our home language. And the problem is, some phrases in some languages are just not translatable in a literal, cognitive, prosaic way. You have to grasp it intuitively. You have to go beyond the sheer first glimpse meaning of the words to a whole plethora of emotions and events and history and experience that give that phrase or word a tone of meaning that cannot be just duplicated by finding a synonym in another language. There are some things that you must grasp intuitively. Over the years, I've told you that I lived and have from my doctoral years in educational psychology, which was the minor of my PhD, one of the minors, and three minors. Comparative religions, geography, and educational psychology. I made a choice in those days in learning theory and adopted what's called the field theory, Gestalt theory, but common language calls it the field theory of learning, where you offer to people the whole mass or field of the subject matter that you're dealing with. And you just go back again. The first time, they're just sort of like you're hit in the face with a watermelon. And you jar, because we're used to learning 1 plus 1 equals 2 plus 2 equals 4 plus 4 equals 8. And we have not been conditioned to absorb the whole. And field theory of learning has the teacher lay out the whole and then just come back and cross the field again, lay out the whole. And lots of times you people that don't pay too much attention think I'm preaching the same message. No, I'm not. I'm in the same field, but I'm coming at it from a different side. I'm measuring out some different posts within it. And I'm giving you the whole instead of piece by piece. And at some point, gestalt occurs, is the technical word. At some point, all of a sudden, an intuitive something happens. And I see it. And then when you've caught the concept of the field, you then can synthesize and fit all the parts in. It's like putting a puzzle together and just blindly fitting the pieces. Or at some point, with all the pieces laying there, you begin to see the picture. And then you are helped in fitting the pieces, because you're not about to put a river piece or a rock piece up here where the clouds and sky are. Follow what I'm saying? The field intuitively hits you. And intuitively, you begin to grasp detail more quickly because your mind has caught the field and gestalted it. Likewise, some of these words and phrases are foreign to us, but they are a device to make the point with more emphasis. God is actually saying here in this inspired word through Paul, the reason that you are accountable and under my wrath for not paying attention to me, worshiping and respecting me, and being concerned about being in right relationship with me is caused from the creation, from the very beginning. The not seen are clearly seen. Huh? Okay. I don't know whether, at this point, I don't know what we're talking about. I mean, how can I understand what is not seen if I don't know what I'm supposed to see? If it's not seen, how do I even know I'm not seeing it? Follow? What fun to talk back to God. I did this for years. You mean you're upset at me because I don't see what's seen? Or rather, I can't see because it's not seeable what you say I clearly see? Sounds like that priest that used to show up on Johnny Carson's show talking gibberish. Remember him? What's his name? Well, he's not that famous, is he? Who? Guido. Sartusi. Sardusi. Sarducci. Sarducci. You always pronounce an Italian C before an I or an E as a CH. I wanted to say Sarducci for obvious reasons. I mean, what is God saying here? Because the things not seen are clearly seen of Him, that's of God, from the creation of the worlds by the things made, being understood, noumena, that means comprehended inside the brain, capable of understanding, forming an opinion. The not seen things are clearly seen from the creation about God from the things made, being understood by the things made. So now I got it. That which is not seen, which we haven't defined yet, about God, so we know the reference points, is that which is not seen about God from the creation, clearly seen about Him from the things made, and being understood from the things made. Okay, what are these not seen things that are clearly seen and understood from the creation by the things made? Where are they? Both His everlasting power, eternal power, and Thyotis, divine being, for them, that's the ones who can't see but see clearly, and understand about God from things made, because that which can be known is there to the ones who pay attention. About God's eternal power, and His being, eternal being, for them to be without excuse. In other words, God has decided that the time has come to unleash His wrath on those who ignore Him, fail to worship Him, fail to reach out to Him, fail to look for Him, fail to understand that He is, He has ultimate power, and that he is supernatural. This is not a revelation of Christ, of God, his grace, all the things that are in the revealed book. It's just, to reduce it down simply, recognition from the creation that what is not seen is clearly seen by the handiwork. That this world we live in and this universe through which we spin through has got enough tracks, as I said earlier in an earlier message, and fingerprints of his presence for man to be without excuse, because that which is not seen, God's eternal supreme being and power as the creator of this universe, is clearly seen in his handiwork. Now, if you have a Bible with an Apocrypha in it, you will find in the Apocrypha that was in every version, including the King James up until the 1870s, when the Bible societies took the Apocrypha out. You will find in the Apocryphal section of the book before Ecclesiasticus, not Ecclesiastes, but Ecclesiasticus, you will find the Wisdom of Solomon, usually referred to in literature as wisdom. Now, to the New Testament church, the Septuagint was their Bible. And the Septuagint included the Apocrypha. Every translation, I repeat, clear through the King James, included the Apocrypha. And the Apocrypha was thus viewed as part of the canonical scriptures. If you go, and I probably should open it to those passages, but if you go in the room of the book, you will find copies of the three oldest manuscripts, complete Bibles in existence. Two of them, there's only one each, one original. One is in the Vatican, 4th century, Vaticanus. The other two are in the British Museum, Sinaiticus, 4th century also, Alexandrinus, 5th century. They will have the Apocrypha. They will include wisdom. It's pretty apparent. I have one commentary that has isolated 20 different quotes by Paul in Romans, most of them in this very chapter, from the Book of Wisdom. Paul was steeped in the knowledge, in the scriptural knowledge of his day. He stands in one case where he's talking to philosophers, and he's going to quote their hero, an Epicurean philosopher. In this passage, he's almost quoting exactly from Wisdom. Surely vain are all men by nature, 13th chapter of Wisdom, who are ignorant of God, and could not out of the good things that are seen know him that is. Neither by considering the works did they acknowledge the workmaster, but deemed either fire or wind or the swift air or the circle of the stars or the violent water or the lights of heaven to be the gods which govern the world, with whose beauty, if they being delighted, took them to be gods. Let them know how much better the Lord of them is, for the first author of beauty hath created them. But if they were astonished at their power and virtue, let them understand to them how much mightier he is that made them. For by the greatness and beauty of the creatures, proportionably the maker of them is seen. But yet for this they are the less to be blamed, for they peradventure err, seeking God and desirous of finding him. For being conversant in his works, they search him diligently and believe their sight, because the things are beautiful that are seen. Howbeit, neither are they to be pardoned. For if they were able to know so much that they could aim at the world, how did they not sooner find the Lord thereof who created it? I add. Paul will go on to say they exchanged three times. And Paul will go on to say, because they exchanged three times the glory of God and failed to worship Him, a Sabian, and failed to give Him thanks, God turned them over. Not turned them loose. Turned them over, in essence, to that which rules this world, the prince of this world, the flesh, and the devil. He turns them over because they worship the creature rather than the Creator. But that's getting ahead of us. At this point, all God is saying, there is this limited knowledge available from the creation, absolutely, making them without excuse, and their foolish minds became darkened because the world, the creation, declares His glory. I quote James Boyce's quote that parallels not only, he parallels the wisdom passage, which in essence blames them for not recognizing the maker of this world, Psalm 19, in the positive sense, with Boyce's translation here. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of His hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they display knowledge. Remember the root for phanerone, fan, at its Indo-European roots, to see and to speak. Intuitive speaking. The kind of voice that enables Old Testament passages to poetically talk about the heavens declaring, the rivers speaking, Romans 8, the creation groaning, waiting for its liberation. These heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of His hand, Psalm 19. Day after day they pour forth speech, night after night they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. In the heavens He has pitched a tent for the sun, which is like a bridegroom coming forth from his pavilion, like a champion rejoicing to run his course. It rises at one end of the heavens and makes its circuit to the other. Nothing is hidden from its heat. Job has a similar passage, arguing with God. God speaks to him in the 38th chapter. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? Or what were its, on what were its footings set? Or who laid its cornerstone? While the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy. Who shut up the sea behind the doors when it burst forth from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness? When I fixed limits for it and set its doors and bars in place? When I said, this for you may come and no farther? Here is where your proud waves halt. Now, I'm sure that leaves about 98% of you dead and fighting sleep, which illustrates what I'm saying. We have come in a scientific age to where even some declared God dead. And I have little doubt, Carl Sagan's a perfect example, one of the greatest explorers of the universe as a scientist, written books, respected, appearing on nationwide TV. He didn't find God in space. God's not saying everybody who looks sees Him. He's saying exactly the opposite. That in spite of the fact that the heavens declare His glory, that His footprint and His tracks are left everywhere, and what can be known, namely the existence of a supreme, someone before whom we must bow, being, person with intelligence and planning and will and purpose, had to form this, that which is not seen, His invisible, eternal power and divinity, that's not seen at first glance, but it's clearly seen as implied, made necessary by the nature of the things that He made. To be made requires a maker. Well, that's what this book's about. That's what this book's about. Why religion matters. The voices of today have destroyed a belief in the supernatural. I read some of this as I read C.S. Lewis' little booklet on miracles. Your starting point has made it difficult for God to reach you. The voices of this century rule God out. Science became king. Materialism became the object of all activity. And this is a generation that must see to believe. And if they can't see it visible to the naked eye or its extensions through scientific instruments, they do not believe. They do not believe in the invisible. Before I read from this book, I think I'll go back to a homely story by Barnhouse. Donald Gray Barnhouse talks about, since our text says, am I boring you? That the invisible things of God are to be clearly seen in the things that are made. Let's turn aside for a moment from the revelation that we have in the Word of God to the revelation we have in what He's made, His work of nature. And He talks about the vast, giant galaxies of space that flow in harmony. And then He goes down to that other world that we stand between, the macro world and the micro world. He says, I learned about this from a lesson. Well, moving from the infinite down to the infinitely small, there are similar universes of smallness making up all matter. Man has not yet perfected microscopes enabling him to see the unseen things that he knows exist, but he's been able to run tests on the effects of the invisible. Scientists today are in general agreement that not only have they never seen an atom, the word meaning indivisible, speculated by Greek philosophers, as I told you, as there must be some little something at the smallest part of reality that can't be divided. So they named it atom, which means indivisible. Now we divide the atom. The scientists are in general agreement they've never seen an atom, let alone an electron. Now, they may, and this is a dated book, maybe something I'll find, because they're now, as I said, looking at shadows of Higgs' bosom, and they see things they used to couldn't see. But scientists today, Barnhouse says, are in general agreement, not only have they never seen an atom, let alone an electron, a meson, a neutron, a proton, or a deuteron. Then you go on. There are names like the Star Trek's Strange Creatures. They're not only in agreement they don't see them, but they never will be able to see these particles because of the very nature. Yet they believe they exist and work on that assumption. Now you think that you see this light up here, don't you? Is that what you think? No, you don't. Photons, little clusters of energy in the simplest definition. Use a complicated phrase, no rest mass, no charge. The clusters of energy and light hit atoms in your eyes and activate what you think is seeing the light. You don't really see the light until the photons activate something in your eyes that goes to your brain. Well, I see that light up there. No, photons are hitting your eyes, and light, by its nature, energizes and activates things. I'll get to that in a moment. These things they can't see, they believe they exist, and work on that assumption. You want to leave now, or you want me to finish? I learned about this from a lesson taught by my older son, who was a science major in the university and in graduate school. He was helping his younger sister with her physics and wished to explain to her what is known as the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. He pointed out to her that we are able to see objects because light, from the sources of light, is hitting everything and bouncing back into our eyes from all the objects we see. And he's skipping over to the little girl, what I just said to you, that it activates something in the eye. Light is composed of particles, which are called photons. I would correct Barnhouse's use of the word particle. Their particle suggests, in the modern speech, materiality, material. And these photons are not particle. They're a stage above particle. Particles are starting to form a little mass and a little bit of charge. But anyway, light is composed of units, quanta, of photons, which are clusters of energy. I've interpreted what he said here. He told his sister that if, instead of light, our barn was struck with thousands of baseballs coming from the source of light and bouncing off in accordance with the laws of the surfaces, we would be able to discern the general shape of the barn by the bouncing baseballs. But if the baseballs hit a lamp, for example, we would not be able to tell the shape, for the lamp would be knocked over by the balls and would no longer be there when the ball got back to us. If a man tried to see an electron, he would have to illuminate it with some light that could bounce from it back to his eye. But the light that strikes the electron he wants to see knocks the electron from its path and itself is turned aside by the force of the impact. It is for this reason that scientists believe they will never be able to see an atom, let alone its component parts. The smallest thing that man's ever been able to see up to Barnhouse Day is a benzene molecule in an electron microscope. But scientists have been able to observe and photograph the track of atomic particles in cloud chambers and therefore know they exist. They're able to observe the effects of their movements and to formulate the laws that govern these movements. That there is more than theory in all this is incontestably demonstrated by the ruins of Hiroshima. Man stands at a crossroads. He thinks science can prove God. No, science can't prove God. God's outside of it. It's as C.S. Lewis said, your previous frame determines how you approach miracles. If you are unwilling to postulate from the things that are made, if you're unwilling to grasp the understanding and to choose to interpret what you see, the universe that is made, as the handiwork of a craftsman, then what is made is all that there is. And a miracle, by definition, cannot happen. But if you postulate, there is a creator, there is a supreme being, you recognize that, and that all this craftsmanship of the universe came from a supreme mind with supreme power and eternal existence who put it in motion like a giant Swiss watchmaker beyond comprehension. And that this supreme being is in control and can at his will intrude into this world that is, then you can believe in miracles. Now, the one sign that God deigned to give in clarity was to intrude once for all in the person of His Son. And so, impossibly deny the rules of science by raising Him from the dead, taking Him off in full view of all eyes with the promise to return in the same manner. That's why the materialistic world will not look at the evidence, because a resurrection cannot occur, therefore it didn't occur, therefore anybody that says it did is a poor reporter and a dummy listening to him. Why do you think I have had so much trouble with people trying to paint me different than I am? God can use untrained and ignorant people, unlearned. He's proven that through history. Not because He prefers the ignorant and unlearned. His terms are such that not many wise, not many learned, not many mighty are going to bow to the terms. Amos was a tender of sycamore trees and a herdsman by trade. But when God got ready to lay down His standard of His righteousness as the schoolmaster for all time, He floated Moses into the court of the king and trained him in all the wisdom of the greatest nation of the day. When he got ready to portray the most important picture of the Messiah, he chose Isaiah. If you know Hebrew, you can tell the difference between the herdsman and tender of sycamore trees style of language, the unlearned nature of it, and the classic style of Isaiah, who above all people is going to portray the most important message of the gospel, the suffering servant Messiah. I get sick of people thinking that God only wants the ignorant and the unlearned. And when He got ready to lay down the New Testament, He picked a man unmatched in learning, the Apostle Paul, to write two-thirds of it. You can hand out John if you want. In the beginning, one multiple syllable. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. Second. One-syllable words. Nothing wrong with his eyewitness report. But one can understand why God didn't pick him to write two-thirds of the New Testament and deal with subjects like we're dealing with in the book of Romans. God's not against learning. But the world loves to sit and look down on Christians doing their thing that exhibit something less than the academic, intellectual standards of acceptability in the modern world. They can dismiss that like we dismiss the Amish. They're part of our culture. Their bundling habits and their rubber-tired wagons and their horse-drawn carriages and their unwillingness to use machinery, it's a curiosity. And you can count on the Supreme Court respecting their right to practice their religion. Just another little inferior group, too dumb to know they're wrong. And thus, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying it's the view of the world. We can enjoy them. We can demonstrate our tolerance because we know that they're wrong, and we are very big to tolerate them. We can turn on religious television evangelists that by three sentences you know they haven't finished high school, and we can watch them gyrate and go through their spewing and fuming and sweating and crying, and it's entertainment. And you can't judge them as fraud because they obviously believe it. They're just too dumb to know better. It's like the little retard in the family. You can show kindness to the retard because he's no threat. But when a PhD from Stanford comes along, I have to be, because I'm part of that academic community, I have to be too smart to believe this stuff. Therefore, I must be the smartest act around. Some of you will remember the meeting we had, a banquet at the Queen Mary, when Ed Masry, the now famous attorney, Albert Finney's double, Aaron Brockovich, partner. He read the letter from, I think it was Ozzie Curtis, who produced The Klansman. He had a letter, and he had a list of all these movie stars. Kirk Douglas, Burt Lancaster, one of the singers that used to be married to Elizabeth Taylor. Can't think of his name. About six or seven of them. Who? Eddie Fisher. And he said, you know, we were playing poker. An all-night poker game. And we stopped for a rest for a minute and turned on the TV. And there was this white-haired guy. And we stopped to be entertained for 5 minutes. And 5 hours later at daylight, we were still watching. We were taking bets. We were spellbound. And the argument was, we were either watching, for the first time in our lifetime in Hollywood, the real article, or the greatest acts we had ever seen. And we were taking bets. Which was it? An act? Or the genuine article. And he said, we ended the night divided. And we listened, you know, the words they didn't even understand out of the Bible. But the votes are not all in. But from me, here's $1,000. So I guess he voted. It was the real article. The point I'm making is the same as I started with the license plate. This sneering world, if somebody with intelligence starts talking, they're going to sneer him off as a fraud. Because the mindset is, miracles can't happen. God's not out there as the supreme other. What we see is the whole ball of wax. And we don't understand it all yet, but eventually we will. And we'll be able to encase all of it in our mind. There is no God. When God entered into this miserable world, and when they asked for a sign, he said there's only the one sign, the sign of Jonah, which he interpreted as the death and resurrection of Christ. And that was such a jarring, cataclysmic, upsetting of the mindset of this world that says a resurrection can't occur, therefore it didn't occur, therefore anybody reports it's a liar. No! A resurrection cannot occur. No, it cannot occur. But if it did occur, particularly in the life of the man who made the most outlandish claims about himself, which the world obviously paid no attention to because they wanted to dismiss him as a good teacher. Know nothing about Jesus. In every source he makes claims so ridiculous, he ought to be committed. And that the man who made those claims, including he would die and rise again and his death would set right something wrong with the whole world, if he truly came out of that grave, then our mindset's got some big holes in it. That's why 3.5 years I dedicated myself to studying the resurrection. And that's why, applying all the research tools of a PhD, which is a research degree from Stanford University, I believe, but you don't have to believe. But God is saying, I am that I am, and I created all of this, and I left my tracks, and I'm fed up. I wish I could speak the way I would speak if I were God. I am fed up with these asteroid orifices. Not only did the world itself get created this way, as we will say in the second chapter, God put a vacuum. Put a vacuum inside the person of every one of His created in His image descendants. A vacuum shaped like Him. That is what makes man a worshiper, and the anthropologists have given up on trying to find a people anywhere on this globe that do not worship. Not only around us, but in us. He created a vacuum that can only be filled by Him. He created the urge to worship, which is perverted, as we will see, by men. Why do they worship the creature instead of the Creator? The urge to worship. Blind and perverted. We refuse to see this. Could not have just evolved from a Big Bang. That has to be the most idiotic theory. And one of these days, in closed session, in $10,000 fee to go in, I will close the curtains and adults only can look at my painting to poke fun at them, the scientists, of my artistic interpretation of the Big Bang. It will fill this cathedral. And to those that have seen it, the 3 or 4 that are sworn to secrecy, and they will agree. God is fed up with those that don't see His tracks. Now, most people, when we talk like this, think we're talking about the vastness of the heavens. How did God be described when Moses said, let me see your glory? Kabod is the root. How does the Shekinah glory come down in the tabernacle on the holy ark? What was the result of Moses' exposure to God's glory? Shining face, that he was not glowed. What raised up Jesus from the dead? Light's energy, which is the most credible explanation to the Shroud of Turin. Light energy. When the Old Testament exhausts words to describe God and use phrases that they are using to express the encounter, it's with light. Light. In this book, this is pretty heavy stuff, and this far along in the message, I hope you'll stay with me. I'm going to read something about, again, the tracings that enable those to see the not seen. It clearly, Phanerone, manifested, illuminated, shining forth in the creation. Light is a universal metaphor for God. Houston Smith's Why Religion Matters. Light is a universal metaphor for God, and what science has discovered about physical light helps us to understand more profoundly than even the spiritual giants of the past could do. And thank God for the young kids that are in here. They will have their brains assaulted in college with continuous disbelief. And if nothing else, they need to hear that God's more intelligent than those professors think He is. Light is a universal metaphor for God, and what science has discovered about physical light helps us to understand why light is uniquely suited for that role. Einstein could say at one point of his career that he wanted for the rest of his life to reflect on the nature of light. Light is different. It is strangely different and paradoxically different. All three of these assertions, different, strangely different, paradoxically different, hold for God, as does a fourth. Light creates. Uncanny as they are, the basic features of Einstein's special theory of relativity has worked or have worked their way into our common stock of knowledge. The speed of light, 186,000 miles a second. What is it, 83 or 86,000 miles of the sun? Somewhere in the 80s. 93. Huh? 93 million miles to the sun. Wouldn't take very many seconds to get there to 186,000 miles a second, would it? Boy, I got a smart crowd here. 500 seconds, which is how many minutes?
8.33.
8.33 minutes. Which is what percentage of your lifetime today? The speed of light, 186,000 miles a second, is an unvarying constant. And I read just a week ago that they broke through in science and they've been able to slow the speed of light down through certain substances. So science goes on, but it is an unvarying constant on which so many things in the life about us are measured. And everything else in the physical universe adjusts to it. Seated in their stall cars, this is heavy now, at a railroad crossing, impatient drivers see the train whizzing past them, while its passengers see the cars flying past their windows in the opposite direction. This is going to be harder than when I, in the God of the Forefront, try to get you to see time as a parade. That relativity concerns space. But physics looks, or locks rather, physics locks space, time, and matter together like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. So the relativity just mentioned turns up in time and matter as well. They both go up. If you're hurling through space, time, your watch slows down. On a bicycle, the slowing is unnoticeable. But if you flew a trillion miles in a fighter plane and landed at 6 in the evening according to your watch, the clocks in the airport you departed from would read 7. All right, let's go past that. And the closer your plane came to traveling, this is what I want you to hear, at 186,000 miles per second, the slower its clocks would run until if you reached the speed of 186,000 miles per second, the plane's clocks would stop. Time would stop. As for matter, the mass of an object that is in motion increases until, should it attain the speed of light, that mass would be infinite as measured by an unmoving observer. Time stops, the mass is infinite. Now let's spin all this around. You're not even there yet to be spun, are you? Now let it, some of you are, most of you, let us spin all this around and look at it from the light's point of view. Okay? Imagine yourself sitting on a particle. I don't like the word particle there either, but okay. On that single piece or quantum of light, you're going nowhere. Light, speed of light is 186,000 miles per second. But if you are one of the quantum among many quanta, and you're sitting on that single quantum, you're going nowhere. You're weightless. There is neither time nor space, nor are there separated events. If from the Earth it is 100 light years to a star, from your position on your quantum of light, the star and Earth are not separated at all. Moreover, it would seem to you sitting there as if the world were pouring out of you. You and your fellow photons, because light creates. It pumps power into the spatio-temporal world. This is most obvious in the process of photosynthesis, where the immaterial light flowing from the sun is transformed into the Earth's green carpet of vegetation. Plants absorb light's immaterial energy flow and store it in the form of chemically bonded energy. If we look beneath the biochemistry of nature's foundations, we see that light's creativity comes to light there through its early appearance in the sequence that produces matter in its successive stages. The phrase comes to light is not a pun. Everywhere in recorded history, light doubles for intelligibility, comprehension, understanding, and underlying all of these, conscious awareness. The metaphorical use of light reveals its protean power. Situated on the cusp between the material and immaterial realms, photons, we call them particles, clusters of energy in the light stream. Photons, as we just noted, are not subject to our usual ways of understanding the physical universe. Everything, can you stay with me? Everything that was compressed into that preceding paragraph is strange, yeah. So it will not hurt to restate its content. Space. Remember that seated on light, seated on a photon, you're going nowhere. Time does not exact from the photons the toll that it does elsewhere. It doesn't grow old because time stops. How could it, when clocks stop at the speed of light? As for matter, photons have neither the rest mass nor the charge that material particles have. In lay language, which cannot get into quarks and gluons and other specks that sound like Star Trek aliens, these material particles, a step down from photons, derive from energy which, using the word in its broadest sense, I am calling light. In addition to having rest, mass, and charge, these derivative particles, a step down from photons, are also subject to time. So they are clearly material in all of those respects. Still, they are not completely material, For no definite position in space can be assigned to them. Atoms are a step more. Atoms are more material than particles are for being locked into both space and time. But even they are not as fallen as molecules are, for isolated atoms are free to absorb and release energy to a much greater extent than atoms that have combined to form molecules, which are almost completely imprisoned in the determinism of our inanimate macro world. If, in some such way as I've described, light produces the physical universe, it is also responsible for its permutations. Quantum mechanics tells us that the essence of every interaction in the universe is the exchange of quanta of energy. A single quantum is the smallest packet of energy that can ever be exchanged. Planck's constant is its measure. Another scientist back in the early 1920s, really, I guess. It is quanta of photons that change molecules in the act of photosynthesis. And they excite atoms in the retina of our eyes to enable us to see. The exchange of light maintains our universe from the level of atoms and molecules on up. What this all comes down to is that the two great epochal changes in 20th century physics, relative theory for the large and very fast, and quantum mechanics for the very small, both relate to light. Everything is created from light, and all the interactions that follow after those created things are in place, proceed by way of light. As for light itself, let us hear for the final time here that it stands outside the matrices of space, time, and matter that govern all of its creation. If you suspect that I'm leading up to saying that physics tells us that light is God, you are wrong. But the boost that physics has given to light as a metaphor for God's creative activity is dazzling. If God were to create a physical universe, what physicists describe sounds like how God might have gone about that job. Now, let me cut through all that heavy stuff. Whether you go out in space or into the microscopic, infinitely small particles and photons of light, to have all this happen by chance boggles the mind worse than a creative being capable of making this his handiwork. And when we come to light, I ask you the question, how could this Bible, written so many centuries before all these scientific extensions of our sensory apparatus and mind, ever came on the horizon? How could the Bible record so accidentally, out of the blue, start the whole creative process of renewing this world from the cataclysm with his first creative act, light be? How could they? Why didn't he say water be? Why didn't he say green grass be? That many centuries ago, the inspired writer did not know what we just read. He spoke the revelation because God knew. He started it with light. What Christian, or at least Christian with the slightest metaphysical ear, can recite the Nicene Creed? quote, God from light, light from light, very God from very God. Without new comprehension after reflecting on the things that this chapter has touched on, what Jew or Christian can read God's first pronouncement, let there be light, without similar gain? For myself, the author says, I add to the above what Reuben Snake, an Indian mystic, once told me, quote, when we Indians first step out of doors in the morning, we raise both arms to greet the rising sun, and in an eruption of praise and gratitude, we shout ho. Not recognizing, they had the choice. That warming sun was the gift of their great father, which even primitive Indian tribes believed, or as Paul will begin to describe, worship the creation rather than the creator, which is a perverted, foolish mind. All we typically see is caused by the fact that photons strike the optic nerve of the eye and are known only through the energy they release, which energy produces in us the sensation of light. That light, though, is a quality of mind, for to repeat, we never see photons, which is to say, light in the form in which it pervades the objective world we don't see. But the light that we see and the photons in the objective world derive from the same source and carry that, the trace, and carry the trace of that source within them, the Creator. In some such way as this, traditionalists see physics affirming with Genesis that in the beginning there was light. And on the religious side, we think of St. John's reference to the true light, which lighteth every man that cometh into the world. That power that raised up Christ from the dead was light from the source of all light. And that same source at the right hand of the Father dispenses to us the light, and thus the life-giving energy of God's own nature that makes those of us that have heard the gospel unveiled, born again, new creatures in Christ Jesus. But the point I am making is that as science extends our knowledge, we only further illustrate as we go to the outermost reaches in the universe and the innermost reaches of the microscopic world. And we don't find the end. We haven't yet come to what is the smallest or the most vast. All working in harmony. All in this vast universe, on this world, where God chose to breathe into one and create in His image, to see all across this globe, after leaving the marks of His presence from the infinitesimal nature of light to the macro universe, that we dare to go around and say, if hell freezes over, I'll ski on it. Unaware of God, not trying to get in the right relationship with Him. And God is so fed up, He will turn you over. And the condition of sin that will follow between here and the 32nd verse is the wrath of God now being revealed as He lets you stew in your own juice to your own end. He is not wrathful of you because of those sins. Those were laid on Christ. He's wrathful because you ignore Him, don't try to get in a right relationship with Him because you don't believe He is, don't worship Him and aren't thankful So he turns you over. And the mark of being so turned over, and thus the recipient of God's wrath, and there's no one worse than those that grow up in the church and have a cranial faith and no living awareness of the light of the world and the light that shines in our heart to change us. You'll see the symptoms of having been turned over. And that's my message.